and welcome to this week's edition of the House of Commons podcast. This is a weekly podcast. We're recording on Sunday, the 24th of February. With me, as always, is my sidekick, Mark Thompson, sidekick or co-host, as he might prefer, who is a Lib Dem blogger. I'm Emma Burnell, a Labour blogger, and I'm absolutely delighted to say that we're joined today by Isabel Hardman, who is the editor of the Spectator Coffeehouse blog. Thank you very much for joining us today, Isabel.
Hello.
So we've got a number of topics that I think that we could cover today, but I think the big political story of the week is the loss of the AAA rating. So is this a disaster or is it just a monumental disaster, Isabel?
I think politically it's really, really tough for George Osborne. And, you know, he's put himself in this position by putting so much store by the credit rating. So there was this great briefing from Labour as soon as we lost the credit rating, pointing out the number of times that Osborne has talked about the importance of maintaining our credit rating and how the Conservatives would do that. So if he didn't think the credit ratings mattered, then he wouldn't have said that. And it's, you know, difficult for him now to come out and say credit ratings don't matter, because they did when we had a good one, basically.
Yeah.
Obviously, AA1 is still, it's not a bad credit rating. It's not junk status, but it is, you know, it's embarrassing because we've had a downgrade. There are only two countries, I think, which still have the AAA, so that's Germany and Canada, and they may not hold on to it for long. But it's the fact that, you know, in previous economic shocks, we've held on to our credit rating, but this time around we haven't.
Yeah, absolutely. And it, as you say, I think there's the damage economically, which may possibly be minimised. This has been expected for quite some time, so it's exactly. Probably been built in to people's planning. But the political fallout, because it was set as such a shibboleth, by George Osborne himself, is going to be much greater. Would you agree with that, Mark?
Yeah, an excellent word as well, shibboleth. I like that.
I learned everything I know from the West Wing.
Yeah, I basically agree with pretty much everything that Isabel just said there. I do think that this is damaging politically for Osborne. I don't necessarily think it's particularly damaging economically, for the reasons that, you know, you've both just said, that lots of other countries have lost their AAA. The US, biggest economy in the world, has lost their AAA, and they don't seem to be doing too badly at the moment. There seem to be some good signs from over there. But yeah, the politics is dreadful for Osborne. In fact, I wrote a blog post today where I'm now comparing him with Gordon Brown, because it does feel to me like the same sort of thing that we heard from Brown about him having abolished boom and bust. You know, I mean, it was in the Lib Dems and the Tories mercilessly took the mickey out of Brown for years after that, and even during the time he was saying it, actually, but certainly after we had the credit crunch and then the recession. The idea that he'd abolished the economic cycle was just risible. But, you know, Osborne's been going on about how, you know, we're going to keep the AAA, and all the stuff that he's doing is all about keeping the AAA rating. He said it over and over and over again, and it was a massive hostage to fortune, in exactly the same way as Brown's abolishing boom and bust was a hostage to fortune. And I actually think that if the political circumstances were different, I think Cameron might actually sack him. But I don't think he will, because he's his oldest political ally. And I think if he was to get rid of him, that would then be reflective of a wider malaise within the government and within its economic policy. But I think, you know, I mean, John Major got rid of Norman Lamont after the ERM disaster, which I suppose you could objectively say was worse than this. But, you know, Major obviously had the chance to basically try and blame it on the Chancellor, as I just don't think Cameron's going to do that. I think Osborne will get away with it, but I do think it weakens his position now somewhat.
I think one difference, one of the many differences between this and the ERM is that obviously the ERM had a concrete and direct effect, whereas this downgrade is more of the verdict on an effect, if that makes sense. You know, something's already happened, and that's the problem with the markets. And actually, to spook the markets further, the perfect thing to do would be to change Chancellor.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a fair point, and that's probably one of the other reasons why he won't do it. But, you know, I think Chancellors have gone for big, big misjudgments, and I think this has to go down as a big misjudgment. I just think that there are various reasons why Osborne won't go, at least at the moment. But, you know, that means that Cameron has to completely own this. He doesn't have the opportunity to get rid of his Chancellor and then, you know, try and move on from it by use of the fact that he gets rid of his Chancellor, because he won't, he can't. He's hidebound. You know, they're basically lashed together for the 5 years, aren't they?
Yeah, definitely.
Absolutely. And I think it's very interesting because, like Gordon Brown, George Osborne is a very political chancellor. He's supposed to be the guy who's not only, you know, doing the very specific things that are wanted economically by the Conservatives, but also the things that are wanted politically. And that's why he's often does things that are quite Brownian in the setting up dividing lines. You know, you've got the division between scroungers and strivers, and that was very strong in the autumn statement, although it's been slightly reeled back since. But he seems to be failing on both fronts. He's neither being an asset economically nor being an asset politically. But I agree with you, Mark. I don't think that Cameron is strong enough to get rid of him.
And actually, there's another way in which he's quite similar to Gordon Brown, which is that Brown used to do his best to avoid coming on the media to, you know, justify his policies and to, you know, to defend when things had gone wrong. And Osborne is exactly the same. He always seems to send Danny Alexander out to bat for him. And that's just cowardice. You know, he should be up there defending things, not just doing a statement to camera that then gets broadcast on the news. He should be out there debating it, defending it, you know, and taking the flak for what's happened.
Why does Danny Alexander keep doing it?
Who knows?
I suppose one of the things about Danny Alexander, this is obviously something that irritates his own party members, is that he's quite happy with the way things are going in the Treasury at the moment. He's not the, you know, I know Vince has been out to bat quite a lot this weekend too, but he's much more of a liability than Danny. You could actually rely on Danny to peddle the Treasury line much more faithfully than most other Lib Dems.
Yeah, I think we've talked on this podcast before about how he basically went native within 5 minutes of turning up in the Treasury. Yeah. And yeah, I'm sure that's why they're quite happy for him to go out, because he's almost like the acceptable, the kind of the Lib Dem face, but still backing to the hilt what the Treasury are doing. So, yeah, I think there's quite a lot of people in the Lib Dems who aren't very happy about that, to be honest. You know, we think he should be a Lib Dem in government, not representing government to the rest of the country and to the Lib Dems. But that seems to be the path that he's chosen. And, you know, I'm sure there'll be consequences for that at some point.
Well, he has much less of a sausage machine approach to government than even Nick Clegg does. You know, he doesn't. Nick Clegg thinks it's important to talk about policies that he doesn't like, but you don't get that from Danny. I think he's much more into the unity. And I suppose part of the reason for that is he's in the Treasury, and the coalition have still agreed to stick to a single economic message on other things like the snooping bill and that sort of thing. They feel they can take different lines. But actually on this, when there's any suggestion that the leadership might be stepping out of line with one another, there's a massive panic because they can't afford to be squabbling over the economy.
They are both lashed to the same mast, and they'll sink or swim together. Yeah. I think that's absolutely true. So what happens next? I mean, what will the impact of this be? I mean, I think economically we've agreed that it's not going to be much, but how long has Osborne got, and what can he do in this budget to turn things around?
Well, I think one thing that's really important and quite obvious as well is that it can't be like last year's budget. I mean, Osborne really needs a budget where he's completely in control. And it goes back to what you were saying, Emma, about his two jobs. Actually, now's not the time to be the political strategist. Mm. It's actually the time to make sure your civil servants aren't bringing you strange ideas about taxing pasties that Labour rejected year after year, and that actually you've got a complete hold over the small print. I think that's really important just from a presentational point of view. And actually, going back to what you said about those divisions that Osborne created, I don't think they worked at all, actually. You know, aside from it being horrible calling people on benefits scroungers, actually, if you looked at the polls after the autumn statement, and even when the Commons came to vote on the welfare uprating bill, they didn't really show the boost that I think Osborne was hoping for the Conservatives on welfare. Actually, Labour was gaining more trust on welfare on that issue. So I think, you know, he may be very good at thinking about strategy, but certainly that part of strategy really didn't pay off for him.
No, and it's very interesting. That happened just after Linton Crosby came in and was very much associated with him. I think that was some, you know, the kind of dividing lines that he brought into the 2005 campaign. And actually, if it's not going to work, then there needs to be quite a quick rethink, because we are coasting into the second half of the government. We are coasting towards the next election, and you do need to make sure that your messages are in place a long time before that.
Yeah, and it does. I mean, you mentioned Linton Crosby, and it It does feel to me a little bit like a resurrection of the older you thinking what we're thinking strategy, which really didn't work in 2005.
I mean, turned out the answer was no.
No.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the fact that you had Michael Howard as the leader maybe didn't help there, because most people probably aren't thinking what Michael Howard is thinking. But in terms of the political strategist thing, I mean, I agree, and I've been saying for years that Osborne needs to do one thing or the other. He can't be both. And I think maybe, you know, with Crosby on board, I mean, I don't know exactly what the internal politics within the Tories of this is going to be. I don't know, maybe, Isabel, you might have a clearer steer on that from your perspective. But, you know, he has to just knuckle down and get on with the job of being Chancellor. The idea that he can do that and also be the master strategist and also spending half his time popping in and out of Number 10 and, you know, touching base with Cameron all the time about political strategy, that just can't happen. You know, he has to be, if he's the Chancellor, he has to be the Chancellor. He has to get on with that job. You know, that it's more than a full-time job, frankly.
Yeah. One thing just on the sort of internal dynamics of the Tory party, one thing that they could quite easily do, which they're not at the moment, which I think could also solve another problem, which is their backbench discontent issue, is actually that, you know, I don't want to make this about class at all, but Cameron's inner circle and George Osborne's inner circle, it's very much people from the same background. And, you know, that's fine, because you can't help your accident of birth. But there are Conservative MPs who are from working class backgrounds, you know, who were born in council houses to single mothers and that sort of thing, who actually could give a different perspective on certain cuts, on certain policies that maybe those in the inner circle haven't quite thought about. So, you know, there are MPs like Andrew Percy, Tracy Crouch, who actually see things slightly differently to the Tory leadership, and they could be kept busy by being a sort of internal focus group or something like that, just to keep the strategy balanced, so it's not just a product of one group.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, actually, because it's something that Tony Blair, I think, you know, he at least tried to by keeping Prescott very, very close. And I mean, Prescott was really one of the inner circle. He was one of the very few people at the centre of the Blair government who, you know, had to be consulted on major things before decisions were made. And he really did represent the working class background, because, you know, Blair from a similar kind of background to Cameron in terms of class and in terms of education and so forth. And yeah, I do think that the Tories are missing a bit of a trick there. But from what I hear, you know, Cameron is very, very loyal to his friends. And, you know, I think maybe he has a trust issue with widening his circle too much. And you know, it's comfortable for him to just stick with the people who seem to reflect the kind of background that he's from, probably unconsciously. But, you know, it's kind of a human thing,
that.
Isn't it?
You can understand that as well, can't you? You know, politics is a dirty game. Actually, you probably want the people who you really, really trust on side with you. So I can understand why he'd end up doing that. But the problem is it then creates you know, this large swathe of backbenchers who don't really feel like they're being used properly.
And I think there is also the problem that he has spent a long time not engaging with them and being, you know, there is a real sense from some of the Tory backbenchers of arrogance around the Cameron circle, and it, you know, a real distance between them that was created by the Cameron circle rather than created from the other side. So it might be too difficult to now rebuild those bridges. Certainly wouldn't be easy to do immediately. It's not something that could be done with one symbolic gesture.
No, he does actually do these symbolic gestures. He has these drinks. He does actually do quite a lot of outreach events to backbenchers. But the problem is that once he's got them in Downing Street for a drinks event, he's not actually that good at working the room. So when he does Number 10 press drinks, he's very, very good at coming around and talking to all of us awkward hacks about what we're up to. Mm. But actually, the backbenchers, even, I'm not talking about awkward backbenchers, quite gregarious backbenchers, often say to me, oh, I went to a Number 10 drinks event this week, the PM was hardly there, and that sort of thing. And, you know, that's almost worse, isn't it, being invited and then being slightly ignored, because it makes you feel a bit rubbish. So, you know, there is I think your point is about it being too difficult is really true. Actually, I am starting to wonder from some of the conversations I'm having from quite a few backbenchers that it's actually maybe a bit too late, particularly with some of these what seem like absurd plots within the party with Adam Afrihiye. They're actually gaining currency. And you just sort of think, well, when you get to that stage, when something that just looks on paper so absurd, there's a really serious long-term problem in the party.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's reflected in some ways. We've seen today, maybe yesterday, that Lord Ashcroft is looking to not fund as much as he has done in the past. I think there might be real issues if the Conservatives don't gain the seat in Eastleigh. And that is looking very, very tight at the moment. I see different polls going different ways quite a lot at the moment. The bookies' favourite is still very much the Lib Dems, but there was a poll from, was it Servation that had the Tories ahead?
Yeah, Servation, yeah.
So what, okay, money where your mouth is, Isabel. Mark and I have both given our opinions over the last 2 weeks. Who's going to win in Eastleigh?
I think the Lib Dems are going to win because I know it's, you know, it's sort of neck and neck because it's within the researchers' margin of error at the moment, but I think they've got the better ground operation. And I think they've got people who are more willing to get behind their candidate as well. I think there is a selection process issue here, which will be discussed ad nauseam after the election. Just one other thing, actually, about these plots. There were a couple of weeks ago, The Standard had a really interesting story where Joe Murphy, their political editor, quoted one angry Tory backbencher, of which there are obviously many at the moment. And this MP said that Cameron needs to pass 5 key tests over the next 3 months. And I'll just read them to you. So one was a victory over the Lib Dems in the Eastleigh by-election. So that could be interesting this week. The next one was avoiding wipeout in May council election. So, well, that's a big worry with gay marriage causing their voter base to sort of decimate. Then preserving Britain's AAA credit rating. So that's one gone. Averting a triple dip recession. Well, we'll see about that. And a successful spring budget. Now, when I read that, I thought, oh, they're setting him up to fail because we knew the credit rating was probably going to go. We thought it might have been September rather than now, but no one was really holding on to it that sort of preciously. Yeah. So actually, those 5 tests, it will be very interesting if something happened next week in the Eastleigh by-election, which doesn't go the Conservatives' way. Actually, you could see these plots growing again and again.
Mm-hmm. Is there time to replace Cameron before the election?
Well, there is, but the problem is that there isn't, as much as Adam Afrio is ambitious, there isn't really anyone who's strong enough to do it. And actually, the message that would send to voters, don't forget Cameron polls above his party.
Absolutely. I mean, I think they'd be mad to do it.
I think they'd be mad to do it.
They might just be that mad.
Yeah. I think if those 5 tests, if he fails those tests, you know, whether that's his fault or not, actually, well, I don't know. I have to say, I find the Tory party slightly difficult to predict at the moment. You know, don't forget that a few weeks ago, Cameron made his EU referendum pledge. And I spoke to Peter Bone shortly afterwards, and he said his wife was singing in the shower with joy. Well, 4 days later, all these plots started surfacing in the newspaper. So you just wonder what Cameron can actually give them, which is going to make them happy.
I think the Tory party are basically unmanageable in that respect. You know, you only got to look at the way that they reacted on the equal marriage vote. I mean, more than half of them voted in a way that was in direct contravention of the way their leader wanted them to vote. I know it was a free vote, but, you know, they basically do what they want. And they're very, very independent minded. Which in some respects, I suppose, is good, because, you know, the idea that MPs are all just lobby fodder that do exactly what the leadership of any party wants, I find quite a turn off. But at the same time, it must be an absolute nightmare for Cameron and the whips to try and, you know, try and keep control of. I mean, I think that it's unrealistic to expect someone like Adam Afrio to be able to accede to the leadership. You know, the idea that someone from the back benches can just leapfrog and become prime minister instantly, I just don't think is feasible. And therefore, if Cameron's going to be replaced, it's going to be someone from the cabinet. Really, there are no obvious contenders who are going to do a job that's any better than Cameron is doing, frankly. I really, you know, who's it going to be? Is it Michael Gove? Is it going to be Andrew Lansley? You know, William Hague already had a shot at it before. I think if Hague had never been leader before, he'd probably be a really good choice. But he already had the 4 years and he's associated with the failure in 2001. I can't see any viable candidates. And I agree with Emma. I think they'd be mad to get rid of Cameron now. I don't think Cameron is going to win the 2015 election, but I think he's probably the best chance that they've got of keeping as many seats as they can.
Yeah, agreed.
Mark, you were in Eastleigh. How was it down there?
Yeah, I was down there for a few hours yesterday morning. I mean, the Lib Dem campaign headquarters was absolutely buzzing. There were hundreds of people over the course of the morning. And I think they said it was a record that I think they'd had over 500 people turn up in the morning. And, you know, I got there and I got given a load of leaflets and I went with 3 other people who I'd never met before. And we drove out to some far-flung part of the constituency and delivered leaflets. So unfortunately, I didn't really get the chance to speak to many people. I did speak to a couple of people as we walked around and actually bumped into some Tory canvassers as well, which was it's always good fun to bump into activists from other parties when you're actively out leafleting or canvassing. We had a nice little polite discussion for a couple of minutes. But I mean, you know, just kind of straw poll, kind of, you know, the number of posters that were up around, because we did do quite a bit of driving around, actually. There are quite a lot of Lib Dem posters up, quite a lot of UKIP. I'd say at least as much UKIP as Conservative. And some of the people I was going around with had actually been out canvassing for, well, one of the guys there, he was actually a student, and he'd taken, because it was half term, he'd been down for the whole week. And he said that getting a very good reception on the doorsteps, but the UKIP do actually seem to be surging quite a lot as well. And there seem to be quite a lot of Lib Dem people who had voted Lib Dem in 2010 who are saying that they're going to vote UKIP this time. And maybe I didn't find too surprising, because I know that this idea that, you know, UKIP is the UKIP surge consists solely of disillusioned Conservatives is never the full picture. It never has been.
No.
But to actually hear it on the ground during a by-election, I mean, you know, they're talking about how UKIP could even come second in this by-election, you know, the way things are looking. And also a couple of the people that actually met the UKIP candidate and said that she was very, very good, you know, seemed to be doing all the things you'd expect, you know, all the just everything about her seemed to suggest that she was quite a good, strong candidate that they'd picked, which I think in the immediate aftermath of Nigel Farage having said he wasn't going to stand, I suppose in the back of my mind, I thought, right, well, UKIP aren't taking this very seriously then. But actually, I think they are taking it seriously. I think they have chosen a credible candidate, and it's going to be interesting to see what's going to happen. I think the one conclusion I would draw from yesterday is that I do think that we are going to win. I wasn't too sure until about, say, a week ago, and then the poll seemed to be suggesting we're in prime position. But then that poll yesterday maybe saying not so much, but it's still within the margin of error. But from what I saw on the ground yesterday, I do think we're going to win.
And actually, if UKIP do come second, that's a big problem for Cameron. Obviously, yeah. UKIP coming second above the Tories, because what it means is that firstly, he's got the fruitcake problem, and he's, you know, a party that he keeps calling fruitcakes have come second and beaten him in a by-election. But also it means in terms of backbench management, you know, there's lots of MPs who do quite like UKIP's policies, and they'll say to him, look, the electorate love UKIP's policies. I think they're very sensible. Why can't we adopt more right-wing policies? Why can't we do this? Why can't we do that? Even if actually, as you say, UKIP is becoming more of a protest vote, where a bit like with respect to Dems, you know, people sort of voted for them without really realising what they were saying in some cases. That may well be the case for UKIP this time round, but it's a message that the Tory backbenchers will be very keen to pick up on if they do come second.
Yeah,
and it's the kind of thing that they can read into what they wish to read into, whereas other people might, as you say, might think of it more as an anti-politics, an anti-same-old, same-old vote. Certainly, if I were on the right of the Conservative Party, it would be a really great fulcrum to put pressure onto David Cameron to come my way.
Yeah, I mean, I think of the main party leaders, I think Cameron has the most to lose from this by-election. I mean, like I say, I think we are going to win. But I think if we don't win, then I think Clegg can point to the whole Hume situation, and you know, there's a level of mitigation there that he could call upon. I'm not saying that that's necessarily the right thing, because I think if we lose Eastleigh, I think that is pretty disastrous. But I can just hear the spokespeople now, you know, the excuses they're going to use. But I think if the Conservatives don't take it, I think Cameron's really going to struggle to come up with a narrative as to why, because I think that Eastleigh, is it either 12th or 16th or something on their target list of Lib Dem seats?
It's the 16th of the Lib Dems, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, without seats like Eastleigh, he's not going to get a majority at the next election. In fact, he'll struggle to even hold the seats that he's currently got if they can't take seats like Eastleigh. So I think this is politically very, very dangerous territory for Cameron at the moment. And it will be interesting to see how they react. I mean, you know, someone's got to lose. Either Clegg's going to lose or Cameron's going to lose. And, you know, the fallout from that, I think, is going to be fascinating to watch over the coming weeks.
I mean, I suspect that Cameron will bring in the usual governments don't win by elections. The Conservative are the lead party in government. It's midterm. We're doing unpopular things for the good of everybody. Arguments that you would normally get. But obviously in a two-party government, that's a bit more complicated.
Yeah.
So the Lib Dems are feeling very good about themselves in Eastleigh, but elsewhere maybe less so. There have been reports this week, particularly from Channel 4 News, of some rather damaging internal problems with Lord Chris Rennard, who was the party's chief executive for a long time. Now, we have to be very careful, and we don't want to preempt any investigation that's happening. Lord Rennard has vigorously denied any accusations of sexual impropriety by himself towards female staffers and female candidates and female MPs. This is what the accusations have been about, and there are now two investigations that the Lib Dems have set up internally to talk about what happened there and what their processes are and should be. Mark, how do you feel about this?
Well, I have certain thoughts and feelings about this that I'm going to keep quiet about for now, because I don't want to prejudice investigations and all the rest of it. So I do have to be careful about what I say. But I'm not happy with the way things are looking at the moment. I'm very uncomfortable with the idea that this can just be sorted with an internal investigation, an internal party investigation. I think Chris Rennard was, I mean, to most people on the street, they wouldn't have a clue who Chris Rennard is. But most people in the party, and certainly senior people in the party, know full well who he is. He was a pivotal figure for many, many years at the centre of the party. I mean, he almost single-handedly, well, that's probably doing a disservice to other people who I'm sure were involved, but he's definitely the person who's most associated with the campaigning techniques of the type that we're seeing in Eastleigh at the moment, the type that won us by-election after by-election after by-election, the kind of pavement politics, the kind of, you know, blanketing with leaflets and the, you know, the Lib Dems winning here and the you know, the squeezing of Labour votes in, you know, in certain seats and Conservative votes in others. All of those tactics and that kind of strategy, he was really the godfather of within the party. And there are a lot of people internally within the party who I am sure struggling to reconcile conflicting feelings and emotions about what he's being accused of now. And therefore, I think it would be better if any investigation was done externally. That's my personal view. Now, from what I've seen, it is an internal investigation, but they are trying to get people from outside to be involved in it. So I guess we're just going to have to wait and see. But I'm not massively happy with the way that this has played out so far, and I just hope that we really can get the kind of, you know, external scrutiny into this situation, and you know, the people who are actually doing the investigating and making the decisions about, you know, what has happened aren't people who feel beholden in any way to Chris Rennard. You know, whatever he did for the party, and he did a lot of good stuff for the party, you know, there has to be proper independence when it comes to scrutiny of what's been going on or not been going on, because we actually don't know. Nothing's been proven yet.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's quite right. I think that there is there are interesting parallels with what's going on with the far left party, the SWP, who are currently having a really, really difficult internal time, because there was an accusation by one party member against a very, very senior party member of rape. And then that was investigated by internal people who all sat on the same committee as the person who was accused. No external people were brought in. He was exonerated by this committee. And the person who made the accusation was questioned in some very, very questionable ways. You know, talking about her drinking, her sexual history, all the things that we complain about when we talk about what happens to women who accuse people of rape. So obviously we're not, so far, none of the accusations made, and they are at the moment just accusations, have been of that level of seriousness. We are talking about someone whose abuse of power, allegedly, was less forceful, but still created a sense that made women feel very uncomfortable in the situations we describe. And when there is that power and that power imbalance, that's when I don't think you can investigate internally, because there is not a sense that the two sides will be equally represented by somebody who is within. So I think you've got to bring someone in from the outside, a fresh pair of eyes, someone who has no history with or relationship to any of the people involved.
Well, I think that's the problem, isn't it? Because even if the internal process was scrupulously fair, there would still be the perception that it wasn't. So yeah. I think just for their own sake as well, that they need to to have an aspect of this that is truly independent. I mean, look at what happened with the Savile inquiry. They appointed someone from Sky News. You know, the BBC appointed someone from Sky News, you know, completely outside of the corporation to oversee and be in charge of that investigation. Well, I don't really see why the Lib Dems can't do something similar. I'm not saying they should appoint a Tory, but, you know, they should appoint someone from outside, really, is what I think.
Absolutely. Isabel, I mean, you're part of the lobby. It's been said, I mean, I hadn't heard anything, but then I don't move in those circles. It's been said that these rumours were flying around for years. Would that be an accurate reflection of the case?
Not to my ears. I mean, there have been plenty of discussions in the lobby about it since, but I think that's all I should probably say.
Do you agree that the investigation should be a bit more independent of the party?
Yeah, absolutely. Not just for the perception, actually. I think I totally agree that you don't want to give any suggestion that this is some kind of internal cover-up, but also actually just in terms of having someone from outside, you get someone who doesn't understand how the party works, and that's really valuable because they don't make assumptions.
I totally agree with that. I mean, I wasn't a member of a political party for many years. I've been fascinated with politics for 20 odd years, but I only actually got involved with the Lib Dems kind of 4.5 years ago, and I still sort of have a bit of an outsider's perspective in some respects, in some ways. It's getting harder and harder to maintain that external perspective, but I do sort of still have it. And sometimes when I'm talking to people who've been in the party for 20, 25, 30 years, they can't see things the way people from outside see them. And I think most of the people involved in this are going to, the nature of the fact that they're going to be seeing people in the party, are going to be so steeped in the party's history and all the rest of it, that there will be a little bit of wood tree syndrome, unfortunately.
Yeah, definitely.
And I think there is a wider aspect to all of this. There, a report has come out today about women in public life and the lack of women in public life, and the fact that we seem to have gone quite far backwards in terms of parliament, in terms of the cabinets, but also, you know, we're just not making the strides that we've been talking about in corporations, on boards, judges, you know, all the areas where there are power structures, there are far fewer women at the top. I know that the lobby has been debating this a lot recently, Isabel. Have you come to any set conclusions?
Well, it was a funny debate because it started off as a result of the midterm review press conference where no women got asked questions in what was quite a short space of time. But the thing is that there are female political editors in the lobby, but most of them are on Sundays or on television, and they weren't there for that press conference. You know, it was just a combination of lots of circumstances. That was slightly frustrating because you actually, you know, if I'd gone along to that press conference, I wouldn't have been expected to be picked for a question because they pick the political editors. So I would have expected my political editor to be picked. So, you know, there are lots of women in the lobby in junior positions, but there's, you know, there are fewer in senior positions. And I think one of the things that's slightly dismaying about the debate is that it does suggest that the lobby is not a woman-friendly place to work, and that's just not true. It's not a sexist place. It's not the kind of place where, you know, people make comments about the fact that you're a woman. You know, I know journalists who started work in the 70s where there were men only bars in Fleet Street, and that's just not the environment we work in today. So I think it just worries me because I think actually I read stories about this sort of thing, you know, 4 years ago when I was starting to go into journalism, and they did make me think, oh, maybe I don't want to work in the lobby because it's not a friendly place. But that's not the case. It's actually a wonderful community. And, you know, I have friends who are journalists in the lobby who've helped me out a lot in my career, both men and women. So it's not this kind of Mad Men situation where you have political editors saying, oh, you can still tell it's written by a woman or something like that. And I think, you know, the clear problem is childcare, actually, because there are lots of young women in the lobby. But where it becomes difficult is obviously people tend to join the lobby when they're coming to the end of their 20s and at the start of their 30s, which is when women start having children. And you know, there are two problems. One is that childcare in this country, and I know, you know, we're not talking about people who work in supermarkets on very low wages. People in the lobby can afford childcare, but it is still very expensive. And I think that's a problem. And also there's the issue of childcare for people working long hours. It's quite difficult to get good quality childcare that lasts until, you know, 9 p.m. or something like that.
Well, I read something interesting the other day. I don't know whether this is true, but it was saying that the creche in the House of Commons that's for use by MPs,
yeah,
I think it opens at 8 a.m, but it closes at 6 o'clock at night. And quite often debates go on beyond that and actually just decide from that. You know, the work that MPs do doesn't just stop at 6 o'clock. So it seems like the infrastructure they've put in place to try and help with the, you know, the gender balance thing and childcare hasn't even been set up to take account of the way that MPs work, which I found quite bizarre, really.
No.
You know, and there's actually quite a lot of underusage of that creche, probably for precisely that reason, because it can't really be properly used by the people who need to use it.
Yeah, there's only about 3 kids in there, I think, which is great for them. But, you know, it's not probably the most joined up service. But there's another thing which I think is interesting, which is actually people coming back from doing childcare, because, you know, lots of women do actually decide that they want to be at home with their kids, which is, you know, fine. But there's a re-entry problem, because if you take, you know, 6 years out to have a couple of children and to be with them when they're young, then actually going back into the workplace, you've lost some of your soft skills. You've lost your contact as well as a journalist, because, you know, MPs might have lost their seats in a general election in the interim. So I think there's partly that problem as well, that people are, you know, I don't have children. Babies are slightly scary things to me. But I think that lots of women who are having children are probably worried not just about, you know, the childcare, but about not progressing or not being able to come back. And in that sense, they can't then take the time out they might want, because they're scared they'd never be able to get back into the industry, even if they would desperately want to. So I think that's something that I have no solution at all to that. But it's just, it's another interesting conundrum which people don't talk about so much, which is older women coming back once they've done the children thing.
No, absolutely. I think also there is a feeder issue. If you look at the places that young people go to because they have an interest in politics and the kind of career paths they might take. So you think tanks, going to work for the political parties, working in lobbying and charities and things like that. A lot of those have just as much gender imbalance, particularly in the more senior levels. You know, women tend to have roles like events manager, or, you know, junior researcher, but they're not the people who are running think tanks generally. They're not the people who are the research director. So they're not getting the experience of the kind of political cut and thrust that people who have a high profile job, have a high profile platform, are coming through. And they're learning those additional political skills that then when you go for a selection for a seat are really invaluable to you, because you've got so much experience that you bring to the hustings. So it's quite, I think there's a much broader political culture where it is still, and this is across the board as far as I can tell, still very much in need of changing the way that we recruit and sponsor people through the processes. So I think there is a real sense that people bring in people like them and they tend to be white men.
I think there's also an applications problem. I mean, in my previous job, I helped with internships. The last place I worked at as an assistant news editor, and actually, I'd say about 70% of our applications came from male graduates. Mm. And, you know, the last thing a woman wants to feel is that she's been given a job or a position because she's a woman. They, you know, no one wants to be upping a quota, do they? So if you've got a smaller pool of applications from women, that just makes it more difficult to bring more women in.
Read some very interesting research recently which said that part of the reason for that is the language we actually use in the job adverts actually appeals to a more masculine ideal. So if we use things like go-getter, you know, that kind of dynamic language rather than networker, apparently the research says that this, you know, there's a clear gender bias, so you will get more applications from men when you use particular kinds of words that sell the job in a particular way.
I also wonder, I mean, just coming back to what Isabel was saying about, you know, the lobby and the correspondence and the fact that, you know, it's always the political editors who they come to first. And if I understand correctly, there's even a hierarchy within the different channels. So they go to the BBC first, then they go to ITV, then they go to Sky, then they might go to like a newspaper or something. So that, I think that's generally how it works, isn't it, Isabel?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, if you think about the political editors of the three main channels, I mean, they're all men. And actually, I've just been sitting here thinking, has there ever been a female political editor of either of any of the three main channels? Because I don't think there has been. I mean, as obviously, at the moment, it's Nick Robinson, Tom Bradby and Adam Bolton. I'm thinking back through, and I don't think there ever has been. Apologies if I've forgotten someone there, but you know, there are some fantastic female you know, political correspondents at the moment. I mean, you know, people like, I mean, Cathy Newman, we were just talking about her earlier on. I mean, she's excellent. Carol Walker on the BBC, and Laura Koonsberg, who used to be on the BBC and is now business editor for ITV News. I think she should be the next BBC political editor when that position becomes vacant, when Nick Robinson decides he doesn't want to do it anymore. She was fantastic when she was on the BBC. And I wonder if there's a bit of a glass ceiling problem in this respect as well, that maybe once we get one or two women in those positions on the channels, that might just help generally for people to stop. Well, the idea that the most senior person that tells them about politics on the news is always a man. You know, why does it have to be like that?
There's loads of really good female television political correspondents, so there's no reason for there not to be a female political editor of a channel soon.
Yeah, well,
Mark, have you seen any panels this week? Because you made me a promise last week, so I'm waiting to hear when you'll be able to fulfil it.
I haven't been to any events, but actually I'm going to the Lib Dem Spring Conference in a couple of weeks, and I'm sure I'll be in plenty of fringe events, and I'll be surprised if it wasn't at least one where it was an all-male panel. So I'll put my promise into action if I find myself in that position. Just
to let you know, Isabel, Mark has promised to stand up and challenge an all-male panel from the audience.
As in, why aren't there any women?
The question of all women.
I look forward to seeing that.
I think we've just about covered everything we promised to cover this week. So Eastleigh by-election, we'll have a result next week, so that should be interesting. I just want to thank Isabel very much for joining us today. It's been really fascinating. It's really, really interesting to get that lobby perspective, so thank you very much.
No, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Excellent. And Mark, thank you as always for being a wonderful co-host.
Thank you.
Or sidekick. I'd also like to thank Audio Boo for the hosting and Kevin McLeod at incomptech.com for the theme music. And we'll be back next week.